Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, Jewel Cabeza de Vaca is going to be with us talking about Camp Corazones and community outreach in public health and talking about HIV/AIDS and AIDS prevention. Right now, I'd like to welcome Ellen Bradbury. She is the Executive Director of Recursos de Santa Fe and the Southwest Literary Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, delighted to be here.
It's good to have you back. It's been a while.
It has.
Now, you have, well, first of all, we'll talk about Recursos, and we have a Santa Fe Writers Conference coming up. What is Recursos?
Well, Recursos is an educational nonprofit organization that we started about 26 years ago with my partner Ginger Richardson, who has now gone on to the Santa Fe Institute. And that very first year, we did a writers' conference because Ginger had been at the University of California, Berkeley, and had done writers' conferences. And we really didn't know what we were doing, but we invited some important writers, and they all accepted it. We were quite surprised. And so we've been doing writers' conferences. We were surprised because we just sort of, I don't know, we didn't have any money or anything. But anyway, the first conference went, and we were off and running. So the first conferences, and up until really recently, they've been based on the conference model where you have 12 students, they submit manuscripts, people vet them, and then they are matched with a faculty member who spends a week critiquing and helping them with their manuscripts.
A week? That's a long time.
It is a long time, and it's very intense, yeah. And I used to think, oh, well, you know, they can go out for a walk at San Cui, or they could go to the Desert Corral. No, they get so immersed in this that they didn't want to go anywhere. They just wanted to work on their manuscripts. So, and then that's fine. But this year I thought, what is it that's really going on at these conferences? They're mostly women. They are
obviously... No, first of all, what's up with that?
Well, I think that women are more likely to ask for help.
Oh, right. And it's like the asking for directions cliche.
Yeah, I think it is. And they recognize that people will help them. And that at a writer's conference, if they're stuck or something, that they can go and have someone read what they're working on. Men, I think, are more apt to just battle it out by themselves. Now, I mean, men do come. But I thought if I did one of just women, you would have that kind of special, more than collegial atmosphere that women sometimes create when they are all in the same boat. And I thought further, what's really interesting is that the sort of bonding that takes place in these conferences, friendships are started. And I got very interested in really the role of story in women's friendships, that I think that's how women make friends. Maybe how men make friends, too.
Wait, the role of story in women's friendships.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Because I think when women are, you know, you're sitting next to someone at the airport and something, and or, you know, some situation, and you'll see, I've watched women do this, and I say, well, let me tell you a story. And the other person goes, oh, because it's something we recognize. It's a little set of signals. We go, oh, this will be fun. Oh, good. You know, a story. We like stories, but stories have almost disappeared in a way in our, you know, we could say faster or, you know, texting. Or the story, though, still has that sort of sacred space. I mean, children say, tell me a story. You can hear the same story over and over. It's your favorite story. But I think that women use it as a way to bond and to say, you know, I tell you a story, then you tell me a story. And so...
Well, it seems like, I mean, I don't know, maybe you can make a case for the idea that stories have been lost, but it seems like everybody is always telling you the story of every boring thing or interesting thing that they do in their day.
But I think it's a way of moving a friendship forward, that it moves you from being an acquaintance to a friend, a story. So I thought, well, okay, we'll get the women together and we'll talk about stories. And it's complicated sometimes to tell these stories because sometimes, usually, they're very personal. They may be stories that other people would be hurt if they heard the story. You might be embarrassed. I mean, there are a lot of caveats in telling these stories. So I thought, well, at this particular writers' conference that I kind of reinvented, we would talk about how would you tell your story? Is it a mystery? Is it a creative nonfiction? Is it
self-help?
Yeah, well, I don't know, self-help. But, you know, have you got the right sort of vehicle for your story? And maybe you have a great story, but, you know, it needs to be told in a different format.
Have you actually seen that? Somebody who started writing a sort of memoir and it turned into a action thriller?
Well, yeah, I think more than that they start writing a memoir and they go, oh, my God, I can't do this. You know, I better make it fiction. I can make it a mystery. Because you need to protect yourself.
And then everybody sees right through it.
Oh, everyone does see right through it. And a lot of, I mean, I heard Natalie Goldberg, maybe on your show or something, talk about doing this. And she thought people wouldn't recognize who was in the story. And, of course, they did. Or, as we were saying, Sally Bingham, who's going to be there, who just out and out told the story of her family.
Or there are attorneys whose entire practice is devoted to protecting writers from lawsuit and in these types of cases.
And it's a very serious thing. Or people put up blogs against you. I mean, they recognize themselves. And so when you start out, maybe you want to think about this, how much grief are you prepared to absorb for telling this story? And maybe, I think that women have more stories than men. We've done in the past a conference that we called, it's not really a conference, it's a contest called Discovery Writers. And the Discovery Writers were almost all men. And they were almost all lawyers or doctors who had one extraordinary thing, you know, a case or a patient or something.
Now, what's a discovery writer?
Well, that's an unpublished writer who has a story. But they're like one story. That was it. They didn't want to become a writer. They just wanted to tell their story. But I think women recognize, in a sense, the joy in telling stories, that it's fun to tell a story, it's fun to listen to a story, and they just sort of seem to have, I mean, obviously this isn't always true, but more stories. And so I just went back to this idea of women and their stories. So it's not exactly a writer's conference, it's more like a conference about writing. If you want to write your story down, how big, what form. And the other thing I did is I excluded poetry because there's so many fabulous poets. There's so many, they should have their own conference. And poets...
And probably do now.
Yeah, maybe not quite. But, you know, like the Iliad and the Odyssey, those are big stories in poetry. But nowadays, we don't tell stories in poetry very much.
So, right, that's true. Up to a point, anyway.
Yeah, right.
We're talking to Ellen Bradbury, and the Santa Fe Writers Conference, Writing Women's Lives, is from July 21st to the 25th of this year, and right here in Santa Fe. So when you talk about it's a conference about writing, do you expect to get mostly, and are you inviting mostly unpublished writers, beginners, or is there also room for people who really have quite a bit of experience already?
People who, I mean, I would just love to have anybody, because I think there'll be a lot of interaction between the faculty and the students, and because they aren't going to hand in manuscripts, they're not going to be critiqued. If they're just thinking about writing or they have written, in this kind of conference, it isn't going to make any difference. I think that the real value will be in hearing women who have dedicated their lives to writing talk about what that means. So we have Denise Chavis, the fabulous Denise Chavis.
She's amazing. She's an amazing writer. That book, Loving Pedro Infante, I think it was called?
Yes.
I've never seen, except maybe in Dagoberto Gilb, who's equally skillful, somebody able to sustain dialect so beautifully.
Yeah, and just get that atmosphere. And she's doing what she calls a takarama. So we're going to go over to Taqueria.
Calorie rich.
Yeah. And she's going to talk about writing and making tacos. And well, the other idea, I've got all these crazy things going on. I thought everyone at the conference should write a corrido. Now,
in English or Spanish?
In English, I think that might be asking too much.
Yeah, really.
And I know mostly men write corridos, but they're stories. I mean, usually about violence and mayhem, but we don't care what they're about. And then Consuelo Luz is going to sing them while they're making tacos. So you write your corrido, and then Consuelo will sing it, and... I mean, they're like ballads, but...
But in that Mexican style.
Yeah.
That's great.
The dramatic corrido thing. So I just thought all the different... Well, I got to that sort of by thinking when I was saying, well, poetry is really more about emotion than story. And, but, you know, the Mexican songs are so emotional, and I was thinking, how can we put this back together? And because they frequently deal with real events... And so, anyway, so we're going to have a tacorama and a corrido.
And this is all at the Santa Fe Writers Conference. Now, one of the things that I think is really important to talk about is the extent to which the acts of publishing and writing have changed. It seems that you really have to be more of a self-promoter to be a successful writer, or is that not the case?
Oh, it's definitely the case, and it's, you know, hard to... know what's going to really happen to publishing, because it's more expensive to promote, and they are asking the big publishing houses, and of course the little ones too, that the authors take a whole lot more responsibility for putting their books forward. So the book tour that you used to be sent around and sit in a bookstore and sell books, well, you can still do that, but now you have to place yourself somehow in the marketplace, market yourself, promote the book, and get that book to appear on somewhere on the bestseller list, or your advances go down, and of course your sales go down. So the idea that an author is discovered, you know, we used to think that would happen, you'd write this wonderful book and everyone would get it, but getting that book out there is becoming much more the responsibility of the author. And
it's just like medicine, where they send you home 5 minutes after the operation.
Yeah, and then you just get well somehow.
Yeah,
and I think it's really particularly hard for authors, because they're not, writing is a pretty much solitary profession, and you're not maybe going to be the right person to promote yourself. It's always easier to have somebody promote you. But this is the world as it is, and the others...
Well, it's tricky, because the talent of promoting and that kind of aggressive being out there in the marketplace in a kind of extroverted way, it seems like a
totally
potentially
different.
A different set of talents
totally
than
different.
An
yeah.
introverted writer might have.
Yeah, the quiet sort of, I think it is.
I mean, some people that can do both, but
not everybody
a talented writer.
Yeah. And everybody is being required by the publishing houses. The other thing that, you know, when you think about all this, that is the rise of the book club, which are mostly women's groups. And, you know, Oprah has done really a phenomenal job.
Yeah, that's true.
Amazing what she's done for books. But the book club as a sort of afternoon ladies gathering thing, it's not like a Chautauqua, and finding, you know, a group that you're comfortable with, I think that's... I don't think it has replaced story, but there is some sort of dynamic in that women getting together. I mean, I
was in a book club and they kicked me out.
Oh, what? You talk too much?
I don't know. I never figured it out. Never joined another one. But there's a lot of them,
even in Santa Fe. There's a lot in Santa Fe. And Santa Fe, if we can go to the literary history for a minute, is a town with a really distinguished and not very well-known literary history, because... When, you know, there's Villagras, who arrives with Oñate and writes the whole story of Acoma and the conquest. And all. You know, there are little literary moments. Lew Wallace holes up in the palace and writes Ben-Hur. But when really around the turn of the century, I think when it really gets to be a kind of big thing is Alice Corbin Henderson, who was the editor of the Little Poetry Magazine with Harriet Monroe in Chicago at that great moment when... T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, you know, the real American poets of the 20th century emerged. They find them, Carl Sandburg. They get them, out here. And then Alice Corbin is married to William Penhallow Henderson.
So basically, even 100 years ago, you'd say to somebody, come to Santa Fe, and they say, oh, yes, I've always heard about that place.
They would. Well, they did. Yeah. You know, maybe it was because everybody had tuberculosis, but that's, and truly, a lot of them came out because they did have tuberculosis.
Yeah.
And actually, just as a sidebar, they're hilarious pictures of Sunmont, the sanitarium where all the TB patients were. They're all stretched out on chaise lounges smoking.
Yeah, right.
Getting over TV.
Those were the days.
But, yeah. But Alice Corbin Henderson comes out with William Penhallow Henderson, who has TB. And she begins to publish and sort of hold court out here. And she invites Carl Sandburg, all sorts of people come out to see her. Mabel Dodge Lujan, one of our favorites, comes out to see her. And
who is more of a character and a patron than...
Yeah.
Than a great writer.
Well, Mabel wrote, I think Winter in Taos is a pretty good book, but and she has this hilarious moment with Alice Corbin where Mabel's late for everything. And so Alice Corbin invites her to tea, and Mabel's late, and Alice scolds her. And Mabel writes in her book, I did not come to Santa Fe to be scolded by some woman from Chicago. they invite everyone, and they have a lot of Robinson Jeffers, and Mabel, you know, has hung out with Eugene O'Neill. They are really the queens of the literary scene, and they're sitting out here in Santa Fe inviting everybody. Witter Bynner invites everybody. Witter Bynner is a big deal writer who has, again, sort of been forgotten.
Right.
And then the literary thing by maybe the 40s or 50s, Merle Armitage is publishing those fabulous books. I mean, there's some really fabulous stuff going on, and then it just kind of drifts away. And now I think we have a lot of very Cormac McCarthy, I mean, very important writers living very quietly, which is great. And we have the Lannan bringing in, you know, superstars,
writers,
which
yeah.
is amazing. But it's, you know, maybe it's more about reading than writing. I don't know if that's a fair thing to say.
I mean, maybe the tradition continues unbroken.
It does, but I don't think it's recognized as much.
Well, maybe was it recognized in its time?
Oh, I think it was, yeah. I think with Mabel. Oh, yeah, Mabel loved being recognized, yes. And Alice Corbin was. But, and if I can put in a plug for one thing Recorsos is doing is we've created a room that's a writer's room, and it has wireless and it has couches. It isn't quite Starbucks, but you can get hot water. And we want to invite, you know, reading groups, writing groups to come up and just use this room. It's free. And it has parking, and you can call us about that room at 982-9301.
And now that's a very interesting resource for people. Does it have to be groups? Can individuals come up there and spend a few hours and do their writing?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's funded by the City of Santa Fe. Thank you so much, City of Santa Fe. Because I wanted to create a space, a sort of a gathering, neutral gathering space where you can come by and wait for a friend, or what it's been used for more though are writing groups that have met up there in the winter, and so now it's summer, and you know some of those are just winter groups. So we'd love to have more.
So you've got lots of openings.
We've got lots of openings.
Is it 9 to 5 or is it? Can you go in?
It's 9 to 5, 9 to 4, and we do have a library up there and a computer. So if anybody wants to just you know come and.
What a great resource, yeah.
Yeah.
How many people can fit in it?
Oh, I think 45 or something like that.
And so this is all at Recursos, which is right here in Santa Fe, and it's Recursos in the Southwest Literary Center. You can find them at recursos.org and at 982-9301. Now, how did you start get into this whole literary business?
Well, I really, because when we started Recursos, we wanted it to be like a university extension service where you could just take different courses. And because Ginger had come with a list of writers, you know, it's hard to get writers' names. You always get their agents, but she had a list of their names, and we just wrote them stone cold and didn't know what would happen. But they, and you know, once you get one going, then you can... But it, I mean, we were so crazy at the time. We didn't have any place to put them, so I put Alice Adams, who's a you know a pretty well-known writer, up in my house and went and camped in Hyde Park. So I guess I didn't know where to put them. We got a little bit smarter. But it's, you know, I think that people do love to come to Santa Fe, and they really, I think the town doesn't disappoint. I mean, it's a town that where you don't have to have everything planned out because the town itself is so interesting.
Now, let's go back for a moment to the Santa Fe Writers Conference, which, once again, is July 21st through 25th. We're talking to Ellen Bradbury. Is part of it also in that question of how to get published? I mean, there's this whole phenomenon of how you tell your story and really talking about that. But then, do you have agents there and people?
We have a fabulous agent, yes. We have an amazing agent, Lee Haber, who's a vice president and editorial director of a new imprint called Modern Times. It's a division of Rodale, and she's published Al Gore, Bill Mailer, Laurie Peter Jennings. So she is going to be there. So
if you're a politician or a newscaster.
Yeah, well, or a writer. I mean, but she's looking for talent. So, I mean, she's a real coup to have somebody like that come. We have... She's not quite as active. Another woman who's published a lot of children's books, Anna Jane Hayes, who put out the Sesame Street books. So we have a whole section on children's books because I think women often think they're going to write children's books. They're not that easy to write, they seem. And then we have...
They seem easy to write. But
well, because they're short, yeah, but...
The print is big.
Yeah, it doesn't. And then we have Sandy Blakesley, who writes for the New York Times, science writer. And we have then Elena Diaz-Bjorquist, who's coming to teach people how to write corridas, but she's written more, I guess you'd call it creative nonfiction. And because one new kind of writing that's come along is this creative nonfiction, and it's a kind of writing where there are rules, but I'm trying to find Lisa Dale Norton, who is really an expert at teaching this creative nonfiction. And this year, rather than having regular workshops, I thought if anybody wants to just have a session with any of the faculty, you can just approach the faculty directly, and they'll say, sure, I'll work with you, and this is how much it would cost. But we're out of that deal. You just make your own deal. But, you know, so in a sense, if you want to advance or you were curious about what any one of these women said, you're just welcome to go on that. But it's amazing to me when I tried to sort of narrow this down, there were so many fabulous women writers here, even after I was just getting local people, and then
just because it's easier to write here because there's just not that much else to do.
No, do you?
I don't know.
No, I think there's way too much to do.
But, I mean, not compared to a big city where you're falling all over yourself trying to decide what of the many things that weekend night are happening that you want to do.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the other thing that, you know, goes on with, like, Lannan sends people to Marfa, Texas, so that you have those sort of moments of seclusion.
Now, that's seclusion.
To finish things. But I think that writing, you know, it's really more sporadic the way women... men too, but I think more women write. They write when they can. They get stuck, they get distracted, and so this kind of conference kind of will help them, I think, over that hump, maybe reconnect, re-inspire, I hope. And then, I mean, if you're really lucky, you might find a publisher. I was amazed that we got this publisher because she's very hot, so that's great. Yeah.
So we're talking to Ellen Bradbury, Executive Director of Recursos de Santa Fe and the Southwest Literary Center, Recursos, R-E-C-U-R-S-O-S, .org, and 982-9301. The Santa Fe Writers Conference is July 21st through 25th of this year, right here in Santa Fe. And when do people have to sign up by?
Oh, we'd love to have people. We've got some people signed up, but we have room. It's right before Spanish Market, so... that's why I put Denise Chavez in on the last day. I thought if you want to really have a fun day, you can watch this Takarama event and then go over to Spanish Market. But I thought putting it before one of our summer festivals is, you know, adds
people
a little
come,
luster.
Come
yeah,
out
come
of,
a little early, yeah.
And, do you get a lot of people coming from outside of Santa Fe?
We've got some. We used to in the days when it wasn't quite so expensive. Yeah, we had a lot of people coming from out of state. This year we don't have as many from
out of state. Price
yeah.
of gas.
Price of gas, yeah. So.
Well, Ellen Bradbury, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like right now to welcome Jewel Cabeza de Vaca. She is the executive director and founder of Camp Corazones, and she does community outreach at the Women's Health Center here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, Camp Corazones is a free 4-day summer camp for children and their families who are infected and affected with AIDS HIV. It's happening in the middle of July this year at Camp Stoney right here, right outside of Santa Fe. This is pretty serious business. Do you have a lot of young people with AIDS?
Well, when we invite an invitation like we have for children, 5 years to 13 years, this is a statewide, okay, summer camp. So we have families coming from all over the state, mostly northern New Mexico and southern part of the state. We have a variety of people infected, okay? We have some children. We have parents, uncles, aunts, sisters, brothers, immediate family, okay, and they range in age. So there's no one particular age group, but mostly they probably fall between 20 and I would say 45.
So these are the people who are infected with HIV or AIDS, and it's the children, the young people, whose lives are affected by
yes.
that, who
yeah.
go to the camp.
And we do have some infected children, but not like the major big cities where the numbers really soar much more. But nonetheless, this disease really, when it touches one family, it touches the whole family. It just spirals all the way down, you know, from the parents to the grandparents to the uncles, the aunts, the cousins, the neighborhood, the school. It reaches a wide, wide range, okay, that people come in contact with. And this is why this disease has so much fear to it, stigma. There's still a lot of... I would say in the public that if I was to say to someone, well, you know, I just came from the doctor and, you know, I've been diagnosed with such and such a disease, they won't shrink away or in any way pull back. But if I came to them and I said, you know, I just found out I have AIDS, oh, my God, the reaction you would see.
Is it because of the association with sex and drugs?
It's a combination of that. It's also a combination that's associated with a certain population. It's also associated with the fact that there's no cure. A lot of people still don't know how it's communicated. A lot of people still don't know that, you know, it's not who you touch or whose cup you drink from. People still believe that. It's amazing to me, after all these years of education, prevention, and all kinds of information out there, that people still are afraid of AIDS. And even if they know to some level the education, they're still afraid.
Yeah.
They're still afraid for someone to come and hug them or shake their hand.
Right.
Or pat them on the back or touch them in any way. They feel that they're going to, in some way, somehow catch this thing.
Right. Now, what actually happens at the camp?
Oh, we have wonderful opportunity. This is a one-year summer camp for kids and their families.
One year?
I mean, an annual is okay. what I meant. I'm sorry. An annual camp. And so... the children come in, the families, and we have an activity list of all kinds of sorts, okay? We start out Thursday with registration. We have lunch, and that's our kickoff. We have activities of swimming, hiking. We have activities of art lessons, face painting, buggy rides, all kinds of games and activities. So there's something going on. We have counselors that come. We assign children to counselors. There's something that I would like to talk to you about in putting together such a camp. Is that we recruit for counselors, okay? We usually get between 35 and 45 children that come, and including their siblings. We look at it about maybe 70 HIV/AIDS participants, infected and affected. Okay, so that's our main population right there.
Now, do all these activities somehow relate to the matter at hand, namely HIV/AIDS, or some of them are just fun, take your mind off of those things?
Well, you know, a summer camp should be exactly that, fun and enjoyment. Our priority is safety, Okay. Our second priority is for the children to have the best summer camp experience that they can possibly take away when they leave after this camp. So our activities are based on children having fun, giggling, laughing, being normal, being able to do the things that other children can do and not in any way feel like they're being separated or in any way, you know, isolated because, you know, of certain conditions. So our camp is based on that. We also really make our activities in such a way that they're age appropriate, safe. No one is ever challenged to do anything more than what they can. We encourage every child to participate so that in the, let's say in the morning we have swimming, hiking, art lessons, and maybe we have face painting. In those four activities, we encourage their counselors to make sure that they participate in all activities. Because you know what, Mary Charlotte, if left to the kids, they would be fish all day long. They would stay in the swimming pool. They love it. But then they would miss out on the experience of an art lesson.
Right.
Or they would miss out on the opportunity of maybe, you know, doing an arts and crafts project they can take home. So we encourage and we really stress to all our counselors, make sure that your child or your children have a real runabout, you know, experience of all the camp activities.
So where does the HIV AIDS piece come into it, if it does?
Well, there's one particular night, Saturday night, that we really reserve for that. We start out with, usually we invite someone from the either the Pueblos or Curandera or a medicine man or a lady that will come and do a general blessing for the whole group, okay? And then after that, we go and we have already in advance prepared an area where we light candles and we all come to this place. And this is an opportunity for everyone. It's their choice if they want to go ahead and take a candle from the center, and they can go ahead and speak about why they're picking up the candle, who they're in memory they're doing it for, or they can just get the candle and just put it in the designated area and not say anything. This is an opportunity where they can express their feelings, their emotions. It can be for a loved one that's either living or that has passed on with AIDS, or it can be for maybe for our grandfather that our grandmother just passed away recently. So there's no real emphasis that it has to be HIV related. It's an opportunity for anyone to open up and express their feelings and their emotions. So it gets very emotional, it gets very teary-eyed, and so we allow everybody to go ahead and do what they need to do. We do have, you know, at hand a therapist and a nurse, and of course we have other people there, so that if it does for some child or children become a little bit overwhelming, they can get the help and counseling that they need. But that is the only night and the only time that we really set aside to really allow loss or grief or emotions to really surface or for them to express themselves. And of course Sunday morning, you know, is another day of activity, but by Sunday afternoon, we're done with camp, and so by then, everything is pretty much normal and back to what it was.
And do you find that on that one night, people really have a lot that they do express through their hearts?
Oh, yes. Yes, I can think of a particular situation, a family. They had just lost their mother. She had been really struggling and had a valiant battle with the disease of AIDS and succumbed to it. And so the family came to the camp after the mother passed away. They had been coming for the two previous years, so we were well connected with the family. We knew what was happening. We knew that the mother was just a matter of time. And so when it came to, you know, again, everybody to express, the eldest daughter, who is infected, stepped forward and she got her candle and did it for her mother. And the emotion and the feelings and it was what she expressed and what she said and how she spoke of her mother and the loss to the family. I can only tell you, Mary Charlotte, that it left us all in tears. Our emotions were very open, very distinct, but it also united us and it brought more compassion. And so we felt much closer to the family, even to something as difficult as that. We felt much closer to each other.
How did you get into this HIV/AIDS work yourself?
To make a short story, back in 86, I was invited to a luncheon meeting of a community, and so I went, and there were enormous people there. There were Christian brothers, all kinds of people, and they were in a huddle talking. You know, in 86, Mary Charlotte, very little, if nothing was known about HIV. They didn't even have a name. They didn't even know where it was coming from or anything. They just knew that people were dying, like, fast, okay? So I went to this meeting. From that meeting, I came away really, really convinced that I knew very little about HIV and AIDS other than what I heard on TV and a few words here and there. I became involved, volunteered, you know, got into various programs and everything. As I attended meetings throughout the state, I began to see another face and another voice that I had not heard before. That was women. And I began to see and hear women and what they were facing and the difficulties of raising a family, sometimes by alone, you know, separated from their families, isolated. Their children in school were being isolated, at home and neighborhoods. The fear was enormous. The trauma was enormous. And the women, you know, were just like, you know, what about our children? We have nothing for our children. So out of their desire and their compassion and their need for something for their children, Camp Corazones came into existence. So back in 96, we got together a group of just people that were interested and wanted to know more how we could help. And from there, we began to put together this camp. And so it's our 12th year this year, and we're still doing it. And we're doing it because we believe sincerely and strongly that this camp serves an important need for children, and it reaches out to their families.
We're talking to Jewel Cabeza de Vaca about Camp Corazones. Now, I was reading before we went on the air about you know, where we are now with the AIDS epidemic or pandemic, and it's still 75% men. But there are certain populations of women where the infection rate is actually increasing.
That's correct. And amazing enough, that population is women that are postmenopausal. And it's really interesting to look into that population because you find women 55 and over that find themselves perhaps for the first time with the experience of menopause behind them, this liberty and freedom of, you know, well, no pregnancy and nothing to worry about. Some of them are widows. Some of them are just experiencing a whole new, you know, change and a whole new turning a page in their lives.
And so they feel like they don't have to use condoms
exactly.
anymore.
Exactly. And or they just go out to have a nice evening with friends or whatever. Turns out that they were not prepared. They were not expecting to in any way involve any kind of, you know, extra sexual activity. And it only takes one time, you know.
And suddenly they've got HIV.
And so here we have a population of women, 55 and over, that are, yes, showing up with HIV AIDS.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Who knew? I guess the women themselves, once they get it. But what kind of education is going on now? I mean, I remember in the 1980s, first there were, you know, all gay men whom I knew about it. It was by the mid-80s. But then the big education blitz didn't really happen until the end of that decade. And then, you know, you don't hear as much ongoing, you know, public service education activity as you used to. You are on the ground doing that kind of education.
We're still grassroots. We're community-based. We're out there doing, you know, we're mostly focused on children and families. So our education that we do, we really do it on a one-to-one that way. We're not
How do you do it? I mean, schools or?
Well, you know, we do on one-to-one. That by that I mean people that either apply to come to camp or they want to know how they can apply. So that is our first contact, okay, to find out and see, first of all, you know, how they came about hearing about us and, you know, what is their situation health-wise and everything and who's coming and you know, what are the dynamics of the family. What we do basically is, you know, we really go into the community, especially if we're invited, we'll go and give good presentations. We usually invite a couple of mothers to come and talk on behalf of their children. We do whatever we can in terms of public media, like now, for example. We appreciate this very much. We enjoy doing this kind of programming. It gives us an opportunity to really mention and talk about things that are vital and crucial to the survival and to the wellness of HIV/AIDS people.
Now, what are the top three or four things that every man, woman, and child should know?
Well, first of all, there's no cure. Secondly, and I'm not putting them in priority, but there's no cure at this point, and we're still looking for one. Secondly, if you're going to, okay, important is, you know, sexual high-risk behavior. Bottom line, that is important.
And sexual high-risk behavior is?
For example, someone goes out to have to a party, or they go out to just have a good time. They're not intending to get involved. They just want to go have a good time. They either get into drugs or alcohol. They lose all sense of what is good and right for them. And so they end up in a situation where they find themselves in a week or so or later being infected by the disease of HIV/AIDS because they were not, they did not plan it, they were not prepared, and so they were very inhibited in terms of being able to use common sense and judgment.
And so common sense and judgment is either don't do it, or if you do it, use a condom.
Exactly.
And that's for both men and women.
Exactly.
Both heterosexual and man to man.
And then the other one, of course, is, you know, intravenous, you know, exchange of needles, and this is a high one. Because again, you know, and there's a program that provides clean needles for anyone. But who plans, you know, if you're going to go out and party and everything and someone, you know, decides that they want to try something or they just want to do it at that point in time, again, common sense kind of just leaves. And so this is how another area of infection is through the exchange of dirty needles.
How do you get clean needles?
Oh, the Department of Health offers that. Clinics offer them. HIV/AIDS clinics offer this.
So the State Department of Health,
yes,
or the county?
Yeah. It's called the Harm Reduction Program, okay? And what they do is programs that provide, you know, services, like I'm thinking of Ayudantes, they do the methadone program. So they will provide, if you go in there and you ask, or they'll offer them for you. So, I mean, the whole point is that if you're going to, for, you know, for whatever reasons, continue to inject, they much rather have you use a clean needle than go ahead and try and share a needle with someone else and get infected.
And you don't have to give your name and
Exactly. Incriminating
details.
Exactly.
Now, what about testing? There used to be, and I think still is, a free testing program for people who feel that they might be at risk at County Health, which is right near the Santa Fe Baking Company.
And also the Southwest Cure Center provides that. I believe it's every Monday. And right now you can find within a matter of a short time. It used to take days or weeks. Now it's a matter of maybe an hour or so or 24 hours, and you can find out your circumstances of your diagnosis. So some things have improved, some things have gotten better. We have longer term surviving HIV/AIDS people.
And is that because of the cocktail that they give?
Yes.
What's in the cocktail?
Well, it's, you know, what they have done is in many cases they have condensed certain vital drugs and combine them into a cocktail that best suits each individual. But it's a trial and error. They have to find out, first of all, how does your body respond? How much can it tolerate? How much can it take? And so once they find the level that you can take and tolerate, then they combine those and then you're on it. But after a period of time, because of the immune system, it either gets to the point where it rejects it, then they have to look for another formula. So you're in a constant chase of trying to continue to sustain the health level that you're maintaining and keeping it that way.
Yeah. Now, is there any hope for a cure? Where are we? I mean, has anybody said we're on the verge of the cure to AIDS?
No one that I know of has said we're on the verge.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's constant testing. There are always all kinds of trials and research. I mean, men and women that are being in programs right now. And we don't hear about it until, you know, we either know that they're partially successful or not. Kind of like the cocktail. They started out with a long list of drugs. They now, you know, have condensed it to just, you know, so many. And that's very good. But there's still some that have a regime of maybe 15, 20 pills that they have to take a day. And that's every day.
And they're very expensive, and if you don't have health insurance, you're in trouble.
That's right.
Now, you do community outreach beyond just HIV and AIDS. What do you do?
In terms of women's health services,
yeah,
or just in general? Well, you know, I've always been involved in the community, so I've always been a volunteer for all sorts of, you know, activities in the community. So I am a grassroots organizer, community activist, okay? In that position, I'm always interested in healthcare, always have been, for those that can or cannot afford it. I'm always interested in everyone having an opportunity to get an education if that's what they desire, if that's what they want. And I also have the desire to help people to find quality, you know, jobs that can support them so they can stay and live in town and not have to move away. We've lost so many of our young people.
That is
they
so
graduate,
true.
Go to college, get an education, but they can't find a job where it's not enough to sustain a family, so they move out. And so I'm really interested in learning how we can keep and retain, you know, the ones that want to stay here, but because of economy's sake, they have to leave. So those are some of my goals that I like to. I like people. I like to keep tradition, culture alive. I like to keep as much as we can of Santa Fe, what it used to be, but we're losing ground on that.
How did it used to be? I mean, what is it that you liked about how it used to be that you'd like to keep?
Well, you know, going to the plaza, it's heartbreaking for me. Because when I was a little girl, I would come with my grandparents, and fiestas was so wonderful. I mean, actually, you know, people may have been, you know, poor in the sense that maybe they didn't have the money like people need now to survive. But it's somehow, some way, all the families some way found a way, and everyone would dress from the husband, the wife, and the children in fiesta costumes. It was wonderful. Everybody had their fiesta outfit. Everybody came out and they kind of like paraded and showed their families, and everybody, you know, congregated on the plaza, and, you know, such and such a person is such a neighbor and a friend, and everybody got in little circles and little groups, and they talked and visited and found out who was living and who had a child and who was doing what. It was wonderful. And there was, you know, music, and there was an openness and a lot of joy. Now, you have to watch out for molesters, you have to watch out for pickpocketers, you have to watch out for someone, you know, that, you know, stumbling and falling on the ground for whatever reason. It was just something that was wonderful. It was very, very enjoyable. I loved it.
Did it feel like everybody knew everybody?
Oh, they did. They did. I mean, right on the plaza, you had everything that you needed. You had all your grocery stores. You had your main shopping retail stores. You had everything that you needed. In within two or three blocks of the plaza, you could do all your shopping, meet all your friends, see all your neighbors or someone you hadn't seen in a long time, do it all in one day's work, and go home and feel like you have visited with everybody that you knew. And you know, and that was really something special. Now, people go to the plaza, and we are strangers in our own town. We really are. It's changed. I mean, you know, and I look at some of the corners, and I used to say, well, there used to be Zook's Pharmacy. Now it's Häagen-Dazs.
Right.
Or I look at, you know, the little small boutiques, and that used to be JCPenney's. And now it's a little mall of small little, you know, stores and galleries. And I look around the corner, and I see so many stores that used to be there, and they're gone.
Jewel Cabeza de Vaca is the executive director and founder of Camp Corazones, and she's a community outreach activist. She works with women's health here in Santa Fe. Let's give the phone number, because you've been talking about a lot of really important stuff. If people want to get in touch with you about Camp Corazones or AIDS, HIV, health issues in general, how do they reach you?
They can call 505-690-4837. I'll be happy to direct you to, if I'm not able to help you myself, I will be happy to direct you to the sources or the people you can talk to. If you're interested about camp, that's the same number that you can call. If you want to know more about HIV and AIDS, again, that's the same number. And again, I invite and, you know, encourage anyone that has a family member that has someone affected or infected by HIV AIDS and you like for them to come to camp, get in touch with me, please.
690-4837. Jewel, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.